Please welcome back to the show, John Durr joins me now. John, how are you, sir?
Mr. John, I am fine. How did your mother like the book?
Loved it. Absolutely loved it. You know, the thing that I love about the book is that it puts a smile on your face page after page after page.
Well, aren't you kind?
It really does. The name of the book is My Place at the Table. You can find it at johndursports.com, along with many other places where fine books are sold. I wanted to start by asking you about a man who you undoubtedly worked with, played with, saw throughout the years, who's being inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame this evening. He won't be there because he's a little bit ill at the moment, but Ken Venturi is going into the Hall of Fame this evening. What are your thoughts on Ken?
Well, it's about time. Ken's been a real good, a good golfer and has been a very good broadcaster for a number of years. I remember Ken from the early days. He had a qualification to come to Augusta to play, but he went in to do his military service and was not able to accept the invitation the year that he was invited. And fortunately, the former members of the former winners of the Masters got together and voted that he be given an invitation the next year. And that's how Ken got into the Masters, after the former winners had voted him in.
I would think, as someone who served in the military during World War II, that had to please you as well.
Well, I thought it was pretty good, despite me being on the side of the Americans we won.
Tell us about how you got to your first Masters and what O.B. Keeler meant to you in your career.
Well, that's a long story, but I'll start it. If we run out of time, or if you carry over until Tuesday, well, just let me know. But I worked at the Gastonia Gazette as a high school reporter when I was in school at Dallas, where one of my fellow compatriots there was a man by the name of Bill Friday, whom you probably know. Bill and I were in school together from kindergarten up. Well, we didn't have kindergarten in those days, but they let us hang around the school. But I was at the paper, and they let me go down to Durham to cover the Duke-Georgia Tech game. And Ted Mann was a sports publicity director at Duke at that time, and Ted had an idea that he would mix up the writers from Georgia and the writers from North Carolina, and they could each tell lies to one another during the game and beforehand and get some good stories out of it. So I happened to be assigned a seat next to O.B. Keeler. And you know that he was Mr. Jones Boswell. He wrote all of Jones. He was at every one of Jones' victories in his entire career, and wrote his story, and was a great friend of Mr. Jones. And during the course of the Duke afternoon, O.B. said to me, "Do you play golf?" And I said, "Well, I play at it a little bit, but not much." And he said, "Well, we have a new tournament down in Georgia." Said they just had the first one last year. But they come back, and they'll be there in April, and has Hagen and Sarazen and all of the good players will be there, and you ought to slip down from Gastonia and take a look at it. And I said, "Well, it's unlikely that I'd be assigned to go down to from Gastonia down to Augusta, but on the other hand, if I ever have a chance, I will." Well, as time would be, that was in 1944, and I had the Masters was coming up the next year in April. It had not yet been named the Masters. It was still Bobby Jones Invitational Tournament. And so in 34, they were still talking about it, but it was the first year. So when I got there, I caught a ride with a cotton broker from Gastonia who was going down for the weekend, and he drove me down. And we went in, and I didn't know enough, John, to ask for a press pass. I went up and paid $2 and entered. But I met Mr. Keeler. It opened the gate to the Augusta National, and the first person I would see would be O.B. Keeler. Isn't that strange? I walked right in and saw Mr. Keeler, and he said, "Oh, I see you made it." And I said, "Yes, I talked him into letting me have a couple of days off, and I'm here." And he said, "Well, have you met Mr. Jones yet?" And I said, "No, I haven't met Mr. Jones. I haven't met anyone. I've just arrived. I'm coming through the gate." And he said, "Well, you've got to go meet Mr. Jones." So OB takes me over to track down Bob Jones, and he introduces me, and Mr. Jones was very kind, and we talked for a few minutes, and he explained and asked me some questions, and he said, have you met Mr. Rice, Grantland Rice? And I said, no, sir, Mr. Jones, I just got here. I haven't met Mr. Rice. And he said, well, oh, you've got to meet Granny Rice. He's the best newspaper man in the United States, and since you're a newspaper man, you should know him. So off we go to hunt Mr. Grantland Rice, and we find him, and Granny said, have you met the editor of the New York Times? He's here. He said, you ought to meet him because he's the big story writer from Augusta. And I said, well, I haven't met anybody, Mr. Rice. He said, well, come, we'll go meet him. So that's how I got started, John. I thought another hour and I'd meet half of the people there.
That's a pretty good day in most people's book, and certainly in your book. Did you have any idea at that time the importance of the people that you were meeting?
No, sir, I did not. To be perfectly honest with you, it was an experience that I had no anticipation ahead of time because I had not looked forward to it. It was merely that I got a last minute invitation and went down, so I had not anticipated what it would be to be at a tournament where these great golfers were, but I certainly adjusted to knowing them quickly and meeting them, and I was very fortunate to do so.
Do you think that it helped you in your career and in the relationships that you were able to forge, that you didn't have a preconceived notion?
Probably, John. I never thought of it that way, but it was opening the Pandora's box to me, and I just walked in, and I felt that I belonged, and rather than, you know, being from the other side of the tracks or anything. And I accepted my place as an observer, as a reporter, and it was just a great experience.
Was that the trip where you met Sam Snead for the first time?
Probably Snead didn't play that year. Sam had not yet become a good enough player. I was there, but Sam wasn't there.
But later on,
Sam came down the next year. I had met Snead in Greensboro. I sneaked off to do they had a Greensboro, what they called a GGO. You're probably familiar with that.
Sure.
And I went up there, and I made friends with Snead. And actually, Johnny Buller, who lived in Greensboro, was a friend of mine, and he was a companion with Snead. And between the two of them, I got introduced to tournament golf away from the tournament because I was seeing the tournament players, but they were playing friendly matches. Some of the greatest golf I ever saw, John, were when the Snead and Johnny Buller and the country kid from Charlotte, the Candy Kid, what was his name? He was a very good player, played on the tour for a while. And they played a lot of exhibitions in which they were just the four people in their caddies, and I was the observer.
And I would imagine that there was a dollar or two that exchanged
hands.
There was
a little exchange of currency, yes, there was. And a lot of it went into Snead's pocket. But Sam, didn't want to take his money from the other pros. He wanted pigeons that were industrialists who had lots of money.
Well, and that makes sense. that certainly makes sense. The Masters obviously has grown into the iconic event in our sport. I know that you spent you spent some time with Matt Adams during Masters Week. Have you been back down to Augusta recently?
Not the last couple of years. No, they still send me a ticket and to come down, and they're very nice to invite me back. And I covered, I reported 62, although I was at 69 of the Masters tournaments. See, I started in 35, and I continued up into the 90s, and I had begun to get a little long in the tooth by that time, and the hills had got a little stronger, higher. I don't know what happened to them, but it was more difficult to come up for that 18th hole after I was 90 years old.
I want to ask you about the book because it's such an easy read. You mention a name or an event and you give it a great description. You leave, I believe, every single one of them, every one of the stories, you left me wanting more.
That's a nice way to do it, you know.
Sure.
Well, I was very fortunate, John, and as you know, in meeting a lot of people. But starting off with with OB and Jones. Bob and I became real close friends through the years, and I visited with him a lot, and he was very kind to me. He made a record of making notations on all the television announcers for the other networks as well as CBS. And one day he was telling me that he really was not too happy that NBC was using baseball announcers to do golf tournaments. And he said, "I'm waiting for the day when they let Jack Nicklaus do the World Series." But he said, "I listen to the announcers, and they make some of them don't know too much what they're talking about." But he said, "I enjoy watching them and listening to them." And television had come in by that time, and so I asked Bob. I said, "Well, I'm sure I make a lot of mistakes too. Would you be kind enough to tell me what criticism you would have of my commentary?" Because I had been known as the longest broadcaster in golf television. And he said, "Well, there is one thing that you say that probably ruins as many shots as anything that the announcers can do." And I got defensive a little bit about that. And I said, "Well, Bob, what is it that I do that is so dastard?" He said, "Well, you will say, 'And here comes Julie Boris, he's going to hit an 8-iron. And I said, "Well, Bob, we got a lot of mail asking us what club do the players use. We need to advise them, if we can, what they're playing." He said, "That's not what the problem is, John. You said he is going to hit an 8-iron. You do not hit an 8-iron. You play an 8-iron. Hit is when two trucks run together."
Which may describe many of our listeners' golf games.
He pointed out, that as we talked about this particular thing, having been brought to task that I was using the verb hit, He pointed out to me that he said, "You know, if you get to figure in your mind that you are going to play, the clubs goes right through the ball. It is a swing. You go back and through. And the swing comes in there when you play the shot." I have told a lot of pros about this over the years, and I remember right when I am in the plane or something with them and mention this, and they said, "Well, your friend of Jones, what has he told you?" And I mentioned the fact that you do not play a shot, you hit a shot. And I've had a great many people say, "That's the smartest one-word lesson I have ever heard. Play the shot." What do you think of that, John?
I think it makes perfect sense. I think that there was a time in my life when I played a lot of shots. And unfortunately, I think I hit a lot of them now.
Well, John said most people smash the ball when they make contact. And I think they somebody took a test one time that said 73% of the people, when they hit a ball, blink because of the hit the contact of the club and the ball.
Tell me about Mr. Jones, something that we don't know. His life has been so well chronicled. He's held in such a regard within the game of golf as the gentleman's gentleman. You knew him personally. Is that the man that you knew?
Yes, he was a most unusual person. You know, he was an engineer. He was a writer. He did many things. He was, I think, could have been in the Supreme Court if he wanted to. He was a very talented person. And he got over the fact that in his early career he had a short temper. You remember that,
right?
he was barred from a couple of courses because of his anger. And he was known to throw clubs, but he got over this and became a gentleman golfer and a gentleman player. What about him did I know? I knew a great deal. I spent quite a bit of time with Mr. Jones, and as he got older, his illness came back, and he was having trouble walking, and in fact, he was having trouble getting around, and he was called to be a pallbearer at Grantland Rice's funeral in New York. And Bob called me from Atlanta, and I was at CBS in New York at the time. And Bob says, "I'm coming up to Granny's funeral as an honorary pallbearer, but I can never walk down that aisle alone with the boys in the funeral. May I have your good right arm so that I can rest on that when we walk down the aisle at the funeral of our friend?" And I said, "Oh, I would be glad to escort you down the aisle, and I'll walk with you." Well, Every sports hero in America was at that funeral, I think. We had from Eddie Arcaro to Red Blake to Gene Tunney, Jack Dempsey. All of them had come to Grantland Rice's funeral, and included Mr. Jones. And the next day, the New York Times, which in those days spent a lot of effort on funerals and weddings, but on the funerals, they would tell you who, if it was an important player, they would tell you who was there at the funeral, military or political or athletic. So they had a list of the heroes who were in the parade of the honorary pallbearers in the funeral of Grantland Rice. And it listed all of these, Blake, Arcaro, and so forth. And then it got down to, and Bob Jones and an unknown friend. So you're talking to an unknown friend of Bob Jones.
Well, it's so great to catch up with you again. I've proposed to you that I come spend a lot more time than this down in Pinehurst sometime very soon. I
you
hope
still
that you
want to do that.
Absolutely, I hope
well,
you'll take me up
I've
on
started,
it.
You know, John, I've started making a list of the people we can talk about. I've got 64 people on the list that I can tell you a little story about. These are the people I've met in my travels. But, of course, at 95, you've traveled a long way, you know. The road's long. Sometimes it's rough. But I'm collecting a list of these, and I'm going to see if you know anything about them or if you ask me anything about them.
Well, I would absolutely be honored to come down there sometime in a couple of weeks.
Well, we'll work out a time on the thing. I'm glad you had a chance to read the book. You mentioned that if the people wanted to buy the book, they can go to the to the web page. My daughter Cricket has a web page on the internet, and that's the way she sells the books. You won't find it in Barnes and Noble because they didn't think I was a good enough writer to publish the book. But it was self published. My daughter published it. And we entered it in the World Sports Writing Contest a year ago, and they had 138 books were in that contest from all over the world. It was judged in London. That's where the tournament came, the contest came from. And they kept notifying me that I was still in the running. I was in when they cut it down to 60, and when they cut it down to 40, and they cut it down to 20. And finally, I got a cable from London asking if I could be in Miami at a television show to accept an award. And I said, well, what is the award? I don't go to Miami just to get third place. And they said, well, we can't tell you what the award is, but you're one of the major awards. So I went down and attended this. It was the time of the PGA convention there and the merchandise show. So I went down, and they had quite a ceremony and on television and so forth. They announced the third-place winner, and it was not me. They announced the second-place winner, and that was me. And then they announced the winner was John Feinstein. Well, he went to Duke, and I never did care too much about those Duke people.
Well, it's certainly worthy. I tell you, I think that if, you know, we're getting to the time of year where there's club pros out there who are looking at, you know, the gift bags for their member guests. This is a unique edition. JohnDurrSports.com is where you find it. It's just tremendous, John.
Well, John, you're very kind. A lot of clubs are using it, and I actually the Greenbrier bought 200 of them to give as a gift at a table gift at the festival, the Sam Snead Festival last year, and we have a lot of people who buy it as a gift for member guests because you don't worry about the time or color or shape or size. It's a good hardcover book, and the only place you can get it is from the webpage that you mentioned, JohnDurrSports.com, or from my friend Tom Stewart here in Pinehurst. Those are the only outlets here.
Well, have you?
Thank you.
Well, I want to ask you one question about the reception, because I know that many, many people have enjoyed it. Have any of the subjects of the books, the ones who are still with us, had a chance to read their stories and reply to you?
Well, some of them have. Some of them I don't let read the story. But quite interestingly, to some of the people that are in the book, and they're about 50 people, as you know, and this is the third book, and these are my various other books. And so I wrote about Hogan quite a bit, and I was with Hogan at Carnoustie for the whole time when he won the Open at 53. But I did not, Ben was somewhat critical of a great many things, and so I did not send him a book. Well, a friend of mine, Fred Simmons, who was a friend of Hogan's, called me and he said, "Did you send Hogan a book?" And I said, "No, I didn't. I would be glad to, but I don't know that he knows that I have published a book, and he's never asked for one." He said, "Well, I'm going to give him one." So Fred gave him a book, and I said, "Well, that's up to you." So Fred gave my book, and a few months later, he was in Fort Worth, and he asked Ben, he says, "Hey, did you read John Deere's book? Did he talk about you in the book? What'd you think of it?" And Hogan said, "Well, he was right, because what he said was true." And I said to Simmons, I said, "God, if I'd known he was going to say that, I'd have called him myself." I didn't know he was going to endorse my book, but he was very kind to me. We had a great relationship at Carnoustie and elsewhere, and I used to invite him to a tournament I ran in Jamaica, and every year he would write me a beautiful letter declining his invitation. So I have a collection of declinations from Hogan.
You know, the only other aspect of the book that I would have loved to have seen photographs of you with all of these folks. I'm sure that there is a library of scrapbooks somewhere.
No, I have no scrapbook. I have no pictures. I did not take pictures. Although I once had a photographic school under Margaret Burke White. Now, you probably don't know who she is, but she was the famous Life magazine photographer in the days of Life magazine. So I knew a little about photography, but I did not take pictures. I enjoyed being with the people and talking with them and associating with them, and I did not feel it was my business to try to interfere with their life, to say, "Stand still for just a minute, I want a picture of you."
No, you know, I can totally appreciate that sentiment. I feel the same way. When I'm yeah, I do.
But John, I'm glad to hear you say that, because to me, I've had people take advantage of who I was or what have you sometimes, and a lot of people, you know, they do something for their own satisfaction, for not for yours.
I think that that's completely fair. No, I will send you an email in the next couple of days and try to arrange for more time. I promise you, 25 minutes with you goes by way too fast.
Oh,
I want to sit down.
You've talked that long already. I'm sorry.
We have. And I apologize for having to cut it short. I do have another guest coming up at the bottom of the hour. John Durr.com or JohnDurrSports.com, My Place at the Table. It's an absolute must-read, an American treasure, to say the very least.
You're very kind, and if they'll go to that website and look at that, why, Cricket will send them a book.
Well, I know she will, and I will be in touch, sir.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. That's John Durr.